Episode 27 of The Exit Strategy. Venture funding hits a 9-year low. What's the difference between dry powder and wet powder? If you're a listener of The Exit Strategy, give us that follow. Now let's hear that count.
1, 2, 3, 4.
You're listening to The Exit Strategy, a podcast that inspires open discussions about financial news and technology today. My name, Marcus McGarian, a recovering SaaS vendor, joined by my co-hosts, Ralph DeFiore and Swadek Mazumdar. And we're sitting down with startup founders, technology experts. Now let's begin.
I'm feeling that now that we're at like around episode 27, we should probably consider like a new intro, you know, maybe we make it a season 2 right now. Because, you know, we asked ChatGTP to write us an intro with the hook. And I got the idea when I was watching one of those TikTok videos. The ChatGTP wrote this woman an entire intro to her podcast. And it was incredible. This, she said, give me a hook. Give me these. I don't know all the terms. You know, I'm still learning how to do a podcast, Ralph. You know?
Oh, that's great. Is that what we're using? The thing you got from ChatGPT?
No. This, we started the podcast before ChatGTP became a public record. You know, like it's
right.
We're talking right. About
yeah, that's
you know,
true.
Say like it's. I asked for it. You know, write me an intro for a podcast called The Exit Strategy, a podcast that discusses financial news and technology space. Okay, then it gives us Welcome to The Exit Strategy, the podcast that explores the intersection of finance and technology. With each episode, we divide the latest news, et cetera, et cetera. It's not bad. It's concise, yeah. But I think we can make it better. I'll figure it out. Maybe by episode 30, we'll redo the intro. You know,
yeah. But or you could ask ChatGPT 30 times to improve it.
Yeah, it keeps making it better. We don't ask our listeners to do more often is really to like, follow, share, subscribe, and all those things. Because the more followers, we've been growing our follower base, and it actually does help. Who knew? Getting likes, getting follows, because all those people, keep getting the pop-up saying like, "Hey, the guys from The Exit Strategy came up with a new episode." And
yeah,
what's interesting is that a couple of the guests that we've had on actually keep getting likes and listens every week. Like every day we pretty much have like, you know, episode with like Gordon Chang that had like, a new like, or something with Sebastian Lay, they got a like, and it's like, you still have, it's interesting. We're building records for people that we invite onto the show.
Mm.
But, what's going on in the market now? You know, we keep seeing here, I think the big one that you sent me the other day was that Wall Street Journal article about venture fundraising hits a 9-year low. Now, I don't think that any of this is a surprise, right? I mean, Ralph, one of your biggest backgrounds is working in the placement agency space. You know, what do you do actually when you're a placement agent, and why is today such a bad time to raise money for venture funding?
Well, I think to get to the answer quickly, it's because the economic environment is a little bit fuzzy now, given what's going on in the economy, the Fed. People are worried. Inflation is another factor. The fact that the IPO market is pretty well closed to newer companies. These are all factors that would hurt venture investment.
Because we're going back to like 2015 numbers, right? That's what the graph here is showing. Q1 of 2015 versus Q4 of 2022. So it was 20 billion versus, you know, 16 to 27 billion in 2015 Q1 and Q2. So we're taking it back.
Oh yeah. You know,
by a decade.
Yeah. Yeah, in the amount being committed. Yeah.
But you know, back in the day I used to do a lot of placement agency work for like renewable energy funds or energy funds in general. We would raise, you know, $700 million funds, but VCs, they're doing 100 million to 300 million, let's say. Mm-hmm. I know in France, the average was around 60 million. And the news article that reported that said that it's up by double because the average fund like 10 years ago was maybe 30 million.
Right.
You know, so the economics have changed completely. I mean, that's price inflation. That's all the joy that's happening in the market.
Right.
But, you know, what's...
You know, Marcus, I would say that it's clear that over the last, let's say, 8 months, we've hit an inflection point. And if you look at that chart, we were hitting all-time highs, right?
74.1 billion Q1 of 2022 was the peak.
Right. And I think it's a natural reaction for people to say, well, hang on, things are changing, and let's put the brakes on and see what happens. I mean, you asked about the placement business. We've been in this business over 25 years, and I can tell you the economy and events in the economy do impact how people feel about investing at the at the level of pension funds, endowments, foundations, who and family offices who commit to these funds. So when they see things changing, they don't want to make a 10-year commitment now. They'd rather wait a little bit and get some more clarity on the economy.
I do believe, first of all, VCs, everyone always say they invest in tech. And we don't see people talking about funds investing in like infrastructure, like highways and power plants. No one talks about those. Like when I was working in another bank about 10 years ago, they raising billion-dollar funds were normal, but the asset classes were much more stable. You know, like, but those investments.
I'm pretty sure people are investing in infrastructure and things like that. Let's face it, they're not as sexy as venture capital.
No. What are you guys building? Oh, it's a highway. It's a 30-year concession.
Right.
We're charging our toll roads.
Right. Instead of finding the cure for cancer, right? Or some orphan drug. So, yeah, there's certainly a lot of investment going on, but I think people have taken a step back given everything that's happening. The war, inflation, much higher interest rates. Don't forget, we didn't go from 5 to 6. We went from nothing to 4, 5, 6. That's a big jump.
It's going to be a hot summer when you get rates above 5.
I think they're going overboard. There's a lot of calls for the Fed to raise rates even higher. Maybe not calls, but it seems like pressure. And I think they're making a mistake. They can't have this inflation come down tomorrow because they raised rates yesterday. It doesn't work that way. And if they keep raising rates, you're going to find 6 months, 7 months down the road, things are really going to get bad. I don't understand what the rush is. They should give it more time to let it work its way through the economy.
There's definitely the issue where you raise rates, and then if somebody wants to do an acquisition or take a line of credit or expand their business to the United States, the cost of debt's just through the roof. You know?
Yeah.
And like, you know, it's not always the best to use equity for everything. right? Because you don't want to dilute yourself. And a lot of the times, if you're very intelligent about using your money, especially if you're a founder of a startup or something, sometimes it's better to take credit when you get it, and then you don't dilute yourself. But when the rates are getting to LIBOR plus 10, which is like 15%, it becomes very expensive. And we're talking about, like, we were seeing these lenders offer, the same lenders that are now offering things at 15 to 20%, giving rates at like 8, 9% in interest only for acquisition purposes, you know, since we have a lot of M&A focus. And it just becomes difficult because it really creates a burden. And the fact is that if you use, in France, for example, I don't think you could really deduct a lot of your interest charges. Like if you buy a house, you can't deduct your mortgage from your taxes. You could do it if you own a corporation, but a lot of the times here, people are still very sensitive when it comes to very high rates. So I find it very difficult for people to do a lot of activity, because we see clearly today in Europe, the M&A activity is just down like a rock. It's just not happening. It's not really happening in the States either. And everyone I feel is like in this wait and hold moment.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I tell our potential clients who are talking to us, and we're asking for an advisory fee and a success fee, and they only want to pay a success fee. And I say to them, look, we could be doing our job and something happens in the economy and everything freezes. And we've spent all this time on your project and now we're frozen out from the achieving the success fee. And, you know, we and other firms can't do that. So, it really, even subtly, it impacts every investor to put on the brakes with both feet.
I mean, TechCrunch came out with that article this week, which was basically called "Dry Powder versus Wet Powder," and it's basically, I didn't really understand what wet powder was, but dry powder is an old term. It basically means the money that hasn't been invested into the market that has been allocated to some kind of VC or private equity fund. And really what the article is stating is basically saying that, like, the venture capital firms are basically not supporting their existing portfolio companies. And it goes well with a lot of these guys that we follow in the VC space, where they actually been posting memes about companies that are not doing so well, but they need more VC funding, and the VCs aren't able to give them any funding at this point. So they've come up with the term wet powder, I guess, because, I don't know, what is it, because they have the money, but they don't want to give it, and they're just being sourpusses, or what?
Well, I don't know if they're being sourpusses, but my interpretation of that is that, they realize there's going to be a longer runway for these portfolio companies.
Yeah.
And they've got to preserve their resources, their capital, in order to sustain these companies, because it's going to be longer to IPO, longer to the next round of funding. And that's how I interpreted, you think you have a lot of dry powder, and suddenly you look at the future and it doesn't look so dry anymore. You don't have a lot of room to maneuver because you got to support your companies in your portfolio, because they're not going to be able to get capital at a reasonable price or at any price in the next 12 months.
I mean, the VCs are literally stating in this article that, you know, all the money that was raised in the past year or two was basically at peak valuation, right? So now they're basically having to cut costs, trim the fat, And then they're saying that the quote is that they're basically walking dead zombie companies. You know, and it what it means is that I guess if they have to raise more money and the valuation's peaked, is that they're going to have to be talking about down rounds. And the VC definitely doesn't want that. Either
right.
the injecting more. A lot of times, though, a lot of these companies get so much funding that injecting money isn't always going to be the answer. I know in France, I've spoken with too many companies that have opted to going into bankruptcy liquidation than let go of their employees. And then they tell me, yeah, it's because we're going to have to pay unemployment. Okay. Well, what if you offered them equity? Because, you know, you want to say, hey, you know, we're not working out, but we know how we could exit. We could pay you later. There's a cultural thing here that's not something that flies. If I was to get laid off because the company is like, let's say where the company generates $1 million, but they're losing 1.3, right? So it's a very small number. And I say, I'll take the equity. You guys have, you know, they confirm to me, yeah, we have somebody that wants to buy the company and we could pay you out in the back end. People here don't want to take those kinds of risks.
Interesting.
You know, so when people, yeah. So when VCs, I guess, I mean, in the United States, I don't think it has anything to do with letting people go or cutting costs because we're very good at that back in the United States. You know, what do you do? I mean, what is that? What exactly are these companies supposed to do in a place like this? It's a different culture. 100%. I mean, I'm trying to read the article here while we're talking. It's like in this scenario, existing investors give more capital to startups that feels that they're unable to raise the next round. Instead of trying to raise a Series B, for instance, they may do an extension round or bridge round of their Series A. But we also discussed in a previous podcast that a lot of times those bridge rounds are actually a terrible idea to the person providing the bridge or the Series A plus, because it usually means that extension capital and they couldn't achieve it in the beginning anyway.
Right.
You know, it's
well,
like
it would make a lot of difference if how many venture firms were backing a particular company, or if it's backed by one venture firm.
Yeah.
But it's going to be expensive, that's for sure. Again, the risk profile has changed. The risk is deemed higher, so the cost of capital will be much higher.
You know, I've worked for a private equity fund, and what I don't understand with a lot of the VC investors today is that they usually don't want outside help, or they don't want to have these extensions, or they don't want to have, a lot of the times they want people to grow organically. And the truth is that, like, I think acquiring a weaker competitor in a market like this or consolidating the market is probably one of the best approaches you could do, because you put the money in. We have that neighbor down in our in Connecticut that always told us 1 + 1 + 1 = 5.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I always feel that, like, you know, it's a thing I keep telling you, if they taking like a principal role sometimes and being proactive in managing a market, which means seeing who your competitors are and consolidating that market with them, will give you more power because you'll buy the customers. So you reduce the risk of acquiring those customers or having to steal it from another customer. It takes about 2 years, you know, to buy another company and to structure it so that it becomes smooth with your company. And I think that's the best solution for this market.
Mm.
You know, because you're not taking the risk. It's not about conferences and booths and scanning badges, which is what a lot of these tech companies do. It's about saying, I know you have these 10, 20, 100 customers that I want, and I'm willing to buy it from you, even though you're losing money today. Because if I buy your company, I have the staff, or we could figure out a way in order to make it profitable. But it's a hard choice.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's very hard. Very hard, because that smaller company that's being acquired, that's somebody's dream. And people are very reluctant to give up on their dreams.
That ego, right? But,
Well, it might be ego too, but it's that's their baby. I'm sure ego has a role to play.
I mean, I think the talking about all this dry powder and all this business that's happening in the VC space is you're seeing these rates going back up. They're coming back to like levels that we haven't seen in forever. I mean, like we're talking about 2007. We haven't seen the 10-year at around 4%.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look at this line. I mean, that's a decade. That's the credit crisis.
Mm.
It's interesting because like we had to wait in 2007. I remember this statistic back then. It was like it would take 20 years or so before a mortgage starts where the average mortgage and the principal would cross. So 2/3 of the loan duration. And I think at the same time, we're coming down to that mark where like you had maybe loans that were about, you know, 5 to 7 years old back in 2007. And right. Then we have now about 20 years go by. So what we have is these former debt securities that we had on the market are really hitting their 2/3 mark. And so the principal is coming up. That's my personal feeling of what's going on with this market. So they're able to raise the rates because remember the Fed, weren't they carrying all those mortgages and all that debt, all those bad debts in their own balance sheet?
Mm, yeah.
So now what you're having is that like they've been holding on to those debts. Now those debts are coming due. And then really what's happening is that the cost of carrying those debts have really come down below the 50% mark.
Well, there's something else going on here. And I'm sure everybody that follows the finance industry knows it. There's a lot of discussion about many central banks are buying loads of gold, particularly China, case in point. And but there are others that are buying quite a bit of gold for their central banks. And the concern is they're abandoning the U.S. dollar because they see the U.S. is unable to control its debt. And they're wondering at what point is there a monumental crash in the value of the dollar if Congress and the Fed don't get it together and preserve the value of the currency.
I've been in this business long enough where like I don't believe anything until it actually happens, kind of school of thought.
Oh yeah, definitely. Definitely. But I mean, the fact that for years China was I'm sure you remember 10 years ago articles about how China was buying up our US treasuries and was the biggest investor. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's changing. And they're buying gold instead.
Yeah.
And many other central banks are doing the same thing.
Yeah.
So you got to wonder why now?
Well, the Gaddafi tried doing that, right? Where he tried to make the Africa bank, and then that would have destroyed things like the euro, the dollar. Like France, for example, we discussed this in a previous podcast that they control the currency of 15 countries. And if you start controlling a large portion of the world's gold and you decide to say, hey, we're going to create a currency behind this, it would destroy fiat systems. But it's just
sometimes I think, Marcus, that all these other countries accept the debasing of the U.S. dollar.
Yeah.
Because they're getting America's defense shield to protect the West. And that's just the cost. The cost is they have to expect some inflation. But it's going to be interesting to see what happens the next 5 years.
Historically, since the Civil War in the United States, we had deflation. So like people would, let's say you were a soldier in the Civil War. The war ends around 1864. And then up until 1913, when the Federal Reserve Act came out, what you had was a deflationary economy. And most companies didn't need a bank to borrow money in order to, you know, build their factories or any of those things. And the money that you had in your pocket grew in value, even if your salary didn't change. So the purchasing power of the dollar became very strong as time went on. And it was very clear by World War One that we had a very strong currency. I mean, there wasn't even income tax until like 1913. And the truth is that like, it's not that like, I mean, we didn't have a debased currency back in after the Second World War. This really only happened in the 70s when Nixon took us off the gold standard. And who do we blame for that? It's really the British and the French who basically called back the gold.
Well, can you blame them? Yeah, but you got to look. You got to look before Nixon did that. You had the Great Society, and you had the Vietnam War, guns and butter, yeah. And of course that impacted it. But you bring up 71 when the gold standard was abandoned. If you look at the price of homes and really any measure of inflation, from that point on, straight up.
Yeah. But that's the thing. It's the basement. But it's the thing is that like you have to play the game based on how the game is, based on the rules of the game. You can't say like, it's like we were talking, I was talking to some people here about anything. I mean, like somebody told me, you can't buy real estate in a certain place because of global warming and the water levels are going to rise. But I'm just like, but there's no bank prospectus or insurance clause or anything that basically says that there's going to be a problem with rising sea levels. It's not even something that's acknowledged, you know? Right. So it's like when people start telling me some creative reason as to why we shouldn't do something, there's always 1,000 reasons why not to do something or another. It's like right now, when we look at the 10-year treasury or we look at the 2-year treasury and we're seeing that the rates are at 5% or 3.9% on the 10-year. Why as an LP would I give a VC money to maybe get 8% cost of capital with a potential upside versus, you know, for the past decade, we've been doing this and that, and we've made on average, you know, maybe 8.5%. And I'm not pulling those numbers out of my butt. I'm saying those numbers because those are the public records that we saw and calculated from a number of pension funds that were investing in these VCs. And, you know, I think what's going to happen now is that we're going to have a very realistic market if you have interest rates up at a higher level, because it doesn't benefit me as, you know, I'm not a billionaire. So it doesn't benefit me if you have like these skyrocketing prices, because I actually have to service the debt if I want to buy a house or service the debt for anything. I kind of feel like a hamster in a hamster wheel when you have like rising prices, you know, keep going up. It's like it could be anything. It's not just houses. It's not just assets. The cost of education, the cost of carrying the student loans for the education, all these things. It's a lot of pressure for a lot of people in the United States. It's less pressure. Well,
Marcus, here, I want to suggest to our listeners that they look up the Kauffman Foundation. It's Kauffman. It's the Ewing Marion Kauffman Foundation, but you can just put Kauffman Foundation and put in venture capital after that. And they did a study back in 2012 about their own investments in venture capital.
Yeah.
And the title of the their study is We Have Met the Enemy and He Is Us. Lessons from 20 years of Kauffman Foundation's investments in venture capital and the triumph of hope over experience. So not a good, not a good experience. And as you correctly pointed out, I think it was about 2 or 3 months ago, how CalPERS venture capital investments, how poorly they did in venture capital. So it's not an easy business to, you're trying to foretell the future, right? What products are going to sell? What management teams are going to do well? what markets are going to be welcoming. It's sort of like picking stocks, the same thing, you know, but
unstructured companies, though.
Yeah.
Like it's always clean on the outside. When you actually become an employee for one of these like multi-billion dollar tech startups, you see the chaos that happens in the inside. And, you know, but it's not only the Kauffman Association or Kauffman Foundation. It's also the Federal Reserve had an article in 2017 that we discussed in a previous podcast that basically said the average person will be better off with higher rates. Like, where do you put your money if you have zero rates in the bank or negative in Europe? You put it in things like VC world, et cetera. But the problem is that it's illiquid. At least with treasury.
Well,
some people
put it in. Do you remember? Some people put all their money in Cyprus banks that were paying high yields, and those banks blew up.
Like their crypto money.
Well, it wasn't crypto back then.
Yeah. There's an article that came out today that says it came out like maybe 15, 20 minutes before we got on the podcast, stating that if you invested in crypto after 2015, there's a higher chance than not that you lost money.
Wow. That's interesting.
It was right. It was tagged on with an article with like Elon Musk and something with ChatGTP. So that's why we started the podcast that way, with a ChatGTP comment.
We should mention that Swatech Munjumdar is in India, and that's why he's missing in action. So we should give him a shout out.
Swatech is never missing. He's always here with us. He's the Holy Spirit.
I wish I could be with him and having some great Indian food.
Mm-hmm. That's right. For me, it was Japanese for lunch. But like... Ralph, it's good to catch up with you. Episode 27 was definitely needed. We've gone a week and a half without publishing something, mostly because just busy schedule. Let's keep it going.
Yep. Hello to all our listeners, and thanks for your support.
All right. Speak soon.
Take care.
Episode 27 of The Exit Strategy. Like, share, and subscribe. We look forward to seeing you the next time and the next episode.